There can be few cinematic genres that benefit more from the power of score than horror. And with It and It Chapter 2, writer-director Andy Muschietti and composer Benjamin Wallfisch have nailed it. So it's a pleasure to welcome Andy onto our latest episode of Soundtrackin', the weekly film music podcast with me, Edith Bowman. Reflecting the shape-shifting abilities of Pennywise the Clown, Benjamin has produced a soundscape which Andy describes as bendy, that switches in an instant from the safe and dreamy to something altogether more dark and twisted. And Pennywise himself appears in a track or two as well, including this one, Dirty Little Secret. Welcome to Soundtrackin'. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Because music is a big part of both of these films.
Massive.
Massive part. But yeah. Before we get into the music, I just wanted to touch on the film, both films actually, and congratulate you on Chapter 2. What was wonderful about going into it was that in preparation, I went back and watched the first film. And it's, you know, it's only a couple of years ago, but it was so, what a great film to go back and relive, to be honest. I think that's how everybody should go into Chapter 2.
Absolutely, yeah. The fresher they have, you know, the first Chapter 1 in their minds and in their hearts, I think the most gratifying experience will be of watching Chapter 2.
Feels like me, you've almost created your own sort of subgenre in terms of it's the double H for me. It's heart and horror, because there is so much heart in this film as well as the horror, but laughs as well.
Yeah,
that's what's wonderful. Is that easy to write?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, life is made of all of that. And this is a story, it's a life story. I know there's a supernatural element to it, but Stephen King knows what life is made of. He's a great observer of life, of characters, of people, of their psychology, and he throws everything. He throws a sink in every story. And I think, you know, I grew up like reading his books.
Yeah.
I'm very influenced. As a storyteller, I'm very influenced by him and his way of storytelling. So for me, it comes natural.
What was the first Stephen King book you read?
Pet Sematary.
And was that, I read as well that because Barbara's a little bit older than you, that she was like, I read them first, then you get them.
No, that's bullshit. Yeah, so total bullshit.
I love that. But with this huge book that he wrote, which you've based these two films on, did you know going into that first film, the dream was to have these two parts to it, that you were always going to make the second film?
Yeah, yeah. It's like you can't start like telling a story without at least having a notion of where you're going. And the second part is not a sequel. The second part is a second half of the story and a conclusion of a story, even though it's like 27 years in the future. But yeah, of course, details and story construction and everything was very blurry when I was doing the first one. So the construction of the second one was a blur that should be like addressed later. But I left a few curtains or windows open in the first one just to pick them up in the second one. So I didn't know exactly what would be, but you know, just it's like throwing a ball in the air, throwing a ball forward to pick it up later. And that happens, you know, when When Beverly, at the end of the first movie, she says, "I saw us all together, our parents' ages, and we're all in the cistern." That is an open window.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I would do with that, but it was like very useful for me to pick it up. And working with the writers, we basically determined that, you know, her being in the deadlights and her having a vision of the future, could allow us to basically, have a clause, almost like a you know, a narrative, device that actually make the loser stay in town, which is something that in the book is a little looser, you know.
Yeah.
The losers stay in town, but you never like quite find out why,
Why?
because they could like turn around and
Yeah.
just get the fuck out of here,
Yeah.
like Richie says.
I'm gone.
Yeah, let's get the fuck out of Dodge before this ends up worse than one of Bill's books.
But I love how with the first film, you held back from having that kind of time jump thing. You know, you kept it really pure to this child experience, and then the second film allows you to really explore how their memory's been affected by trauma and how they don't remember things, but by being together and almost igniting those memories, things were actually different in certain ways and shapes and forms. So clever.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. It's you know, it's a teamwork. I work with Gary Doberman on the script. Of course, based on Stephen King's exceptional book. But with Gary, we did you know, some construction, and then with Jason Fuchs
Yeah.
later, the other screenwriter, that really took us to, you know, he was there all through production, and it's a constant discovery, you know, and
Yeah.
your story grows and grows and grows, and you're lucky that you only have like 4 months or 3 months before the movie starts, you know, because otherwise it would
Keep going.
keep refining itself, refining itself.
That's amazing. So almost that deadline helped in a way in terms of like, we got to start shooting this. Yeah,
But once
amazing.
you start shooting, you
Still
keep on
changing.
changing the story, you know,
Yeah.
and you discover things. And even as a director, I like keeping being open. I'm a storyboarder, so I'm like obsessive about shots
Yeah.
and framing and blocking a scene. But more and more, I'm open to what's going on in the scene on the day. And being open to changes or things that I wasn't expecting, and things that actually improve, not only can improve the scene, but also can have a ripple effect on the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's
That's
being attentive to that is what makes, I think, a good director, and it's a learning curve.
you listen and you feel things as they're happening. It's
Yeah.
important. With music, when you were writing the first one, was it really obvious to you as to the role that music would have in the film, both in terms of using Benjamin for the score, but using those fantastic needle drops, be it that Young
Yeah.
MC track or whatever, you know what I mean? Kind of all those different things.
Yeah. Like finding the music for the movie, soundtrack. I mean, the score as well as like needle drops was always a lot of fun for me. The emotional impact of the scenes of a sequence of a movie is so dependent on the score. And I wanted you know, a score that could get you there, that could take the audience on a journey. But like basically, like, you know, melt their heart if it's necessary, be sentimental at points, which is the probably hardest thing, you know, for us. Like emotional for us, like different thing, different music means different things to us. So it's hard to calibrate that when you're talking with a composer. But we found our middle ground with Ben Wolfish, who is you know, he's a genius.
Conversations you had with him in terms of when that, you know, when that first meeting in terms of, you know, I want you to do this film, what were the conversations that you had about, I don't know, the inspiration or the, or how you envisaged that soundscape to be?
Well, there was a lot of, you know, references that I have that mean a lot to me. Eric Satie has a lot of, you know, of bring a lot of emotions to me. Not necessarily like warm emotions, but emotions of weirdness and uncertainty. That's why when you hear 27 Years, which is the opening piece, which is actually the piece that, that Georgie Mum is playing on the piano. It's magical and mysterious. It's uncertain, you know. It's like it puts you in a place where reality and fantasy have a blurry line that separates them. And it's exactly what happens, you know. It's like in that, that sequence, we see Georgie going into the basement, believing that there's a monster in the basement, and he's not real. What's true and what's not? And it's a theme that sort of happens in the rest for the, in the rest of the movie. That's why that theme is reprised over and over.
It's such a clever way of the audience physically affecting them in a way as well. You hear that because music does that. Music has that physical thing with you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, like, you know, it all comes from somewhere. Like, I think in the past, listening to Maurice Jarre's soundtrack of Jacob's Ladder, the movie opens with that Satie-esque theme that is like, it's a progress, it's chords, it's like a scale. It's just like, immediately puts you in a state of a dreamlike uncertainty and a journey. that's the thing that, you know, it's like it's imprinted in my heart. And when it comes to, and I did it in Mama too, working with Fernando Velázquez, I referenced that Satie-esque feeling. And when the, I don't know if you saw Mama, when you have the family, these, like, when Nicolai Coster-Waldau is like roaming around in the, after having the car accident and has no fucking idea where they're going, he's like roaming around with these like two children, they're 3 and 1 year old, and there's like, on one hand there's like uncertainty of how they're gonna end up, confusion, but also there's something magical and mysterious, which is they're walking into the realm of something supernatural.
And that music's almost the carrier, isn't it? That's the wonderful
and that,
thing.
And the music is what carries that.
There's an amazing piece of score in the first film where she's in the bathtub, she's reading the card, and then the voices, the journey of A, that character, but that piece of score.
Yeah.
In the space of maybe 45 seconds or something is incredible.
I know. There's a concept of shape-shifting that we took with Ben. We talked a lot about it. Like, you know, it is a shape-shifter. Mm-hmm. And the music is a shapeshifter too, because, you know, especially this movie, this narrative, that nothing is what it looks like, you know. Pennywise is a trickster, so shows you something that bends into something else, and the music is very bendy also in our movie, you know. Actually, I think the piece that you reference melts into something darker.
Yeah.
It's very, very, you know, warm and sweet.
Yeah, it's love. It's a love letter, and then suddenly it's like...
it bends into something darker. Second movie, something similar happens when Jessica Chastain, Beverly, adult Beverly, is reading the postcard, mm-hmm. and suddenly the camera like finds a new position, and we see the old lady at the the end of the hallway.
Yeah.
And the music also, like, it's very sweet, and then it's it bends.
There's another bit as well where Eddie is being chased outside the house, kind of thing. And there's almost a kind of like, almost like a kind of beat thing to it, which is really great.
So brutal, and it's like, you know, something that I wanted to bring, and I know where that is coming from. That comes from The Entity, which is a movie that I love.
I haven't seen that one.
The Entity is Barbara Hershey. It's based on a real, true story about a woman who was, who claimed to be raped by an entity, by an invisible spirit or demon. Yeah, it's based on that. And apparently, like, there's very weird things happen. Like, you know, it was not only her, but also her son was also, like, attacked, and his arm was broken. Anyway, so that movie was made in, like, I think it was 81 or something, mm-hmm. or 82. And the score was brutal. The score, the theme of the entity was chow, 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 chow. I never heard something so relentless and scary. And it was a simple, you know, it was a guitar. It was an electric guitar that kept going and going. That imprinted me. When I first saw the movie, I was like, this is blowing my mind. I know that Tarantino used it again on Inglourious Bastards. Yeah. But it's something that when I saw the movie, it's like, this is something I've never heard something like this. I never will again. This is so raw and so brutal that it's like, so I tried to sort of recreate that energy.
How does it work with when you're choosing those needle drops, though? Mm-hmm. Is that your personal choice? Is it?
How does it... most of them are songs that mean something to me.
Yeah.
And they depend on the mood of the scene, and the time where the scene takes place. Of course, you know, being in the 80s, I considered a lot of tunes from the 80s, but I didn't want to go to the early 80s because, you know, it's a story that happens in 89, mm-hmm. which you saw. It's like, it's a weird, like awkward transition from the 80s to the 90s.
I loved it. I can vouch for that.
Yeah. Yeah, because it sort of like started like defacing a little bit of that expressionism that the 80s have that was so cheesy but so powerful.
Yeah.
It's not Pat Benatar anymore, you know? Yeah. Now it's something else. It's like Debbie Gibson or so.
I really annoyed the guy that I was sat next to when I rewatched the first one, and I was just watching the end of it before I went into the film. And I was singing along to the New Kids on the Block and all that kind of thing. It's like really annoying people with all that kind of stuff as well. But it is. That's the wonderful thing about the song choices, that the memory is such a big part of the story. As a film fan, you're watching it and it suddenly clicks in a memory of your own.
Yeah.
Which can be scary sometimes, particularly when it's New Kids on the Block.
I was never a fan of New Kids on the Block, but I know that they existed in those years, and the kids like those could easily like fall for them.
Take a chance. Just get on the floor and do the New Kids dance. Don't worry about nothing, cause it won't take long. We're gonna put you in a trance with our funky song. Cause you gotta be hanging tough.
But I like, you know, the fact that it was mainly, you know, attracted to, you know, a band that was, because it's a boy band, it was more attracted to girls. But Ben loves them, and he's a little embarrassed.
I love when she just opens the door for the door. The posters on the back.
That was a great joke.
Posters. There's so many posters in the film, which I loved as well. Mm-hmm. So Lost Boys, Michael J. Fox. I had Michael J. Fox on my wall. You've got Mail as well. It's kind of all these little... things that, and I don't know if this was deliberate or not, but and we're putting this out a week after the film's out, so you know, because mm-hmm. we don't want any spoilers for anyone as well. But Stephen King makes a cameo, and his T-shirt that he's wearing in the film is the Neil Young Harvest T-shirt. Am I right?
It is. Yeah, yes. you're right. Yeah.
Such Harvest. A geek. I noticed that. Was that his choice or your choice?
No. Here's the funny thing. So we get, you know, I'm talking to the costume designer, and I say, well, let's bring something that is like rock and roll for someone like, you know, like that character could be good, and also like, well, you know, Neil Young, you know, he's like quoted in the book a thousand times. So it comes the day, on the day of the shoot, we come and we give him the T-shirt, and he's like, I don't like Neil Young. Never liked him. Never liked his music. And I'm like, oh, okay. Because in the book, you know, there's so much. But anyway, doesn't matter. But I'll use it. Anyway, I'll wear it. It's fine.
That's
so funny. But yeah, there's you know, other, you know, every song has a story. Every song that you hear, chapter one has like more needle drops. The ones that are more personal are probably the Cult, Love Removal Machine at the beginning, and Six Different Ways in the scene with where they're cleaning the blood. The Head on the Door for me was a very important record, you know, album, like growing up. And Six Different Ways was such a weird and beautiful And I didn't remember that because I hadn't heard that song in so long.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a hit, you know, from that album. But I heard it so many times when I was like, you know, in my I was like 11 or 12 or whatever. Now probably a little older, like 13.
And you it was put Kim. Your memory in there.
Yeah. And it was Kim Baum who was in the music team of the movie. She's a connoisseur. She's incredible, and she brought me this. Well, how about Six Different Ways? And I'm like, what? Wow. Oh my God, this song! I remember, and it fits so well, but it also is so weird.
Yeah.
And the weirdness that Robert Smith has, you know, with his voice, very particular. It takes you to a very, like, beautiful but weird mood. And it's also, it's Six Different Ways, which is, you know, the losers are six boys, six different ways of loving Beverly. They're all attracted by Beverly in one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So it was very relevant to that. And it's a scene where, like, Ben watches, you know, Beverly and Bill are bonding, and it's so sad.
Yeah.
And it's great. And it's funny how, you know, I wanted to use that song and blend it into an orchestra.
Yeah.
And you see how, like, Six Different Ways suddenly turns into score.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't easy. And, you know, given more time, we probably could have done, like, more things. But, you know, it still works.
Before we finish, there's a couple of bits of score in particular from chapter two that I wanted to pull out as well, which is that scene where he's shouting, "Why him? Why him? Why him? Why him?"
Oh yeah, yeah.
I was sobbing at that point.
It's very dramatic and it's very emotional because it brings like everything that is wrong with in Bill's heart, you know, which is he feels guilty for. Well, not yet, but of course there's something inside that is telling him, you know, he's dead because you didn't care for him. It's funny because with Ben Wolfish, he had a version of that song that has a chord that I don't like. You know, I'm musical. I'm not a composer or anything, but I'm musical. And there's something that I don't like, I can identify.
You
and
feel
there
it.
Was a chord that I was just completely unempathic to me. It didn't like add to the emotion. It just like step on a different direction. And Ben like completely understood it. He didn't feel that chord was ugly. But he got me.
Yeah.
He totally got me. And he said, okay, we're gonna do it. And Ben is fantastical. You know, he's like such a patience working with me.
Mm-hmm.
So he redid it. And now I can live with that without saying, oh, that chord. I don't like that chord.
Yeah.
it's difficult with music.
You can't describe it though. It's a physical thing. It kind of kind of makes you feel slightly disjointed in a way. Totally.
I think that score is some variation of the Georgie theme.
Yeah.
That is so emotional in the first one.
Thank you so much for your time and congratulations.
Of course.
On the
Let
film.
Me just like the end, like that. My last anecdote of the needle drop. Probably like I'm missing some, but we have a love removal machine at the beginning.
Yeah,
we've been looking for a lot. You know, we were trying songs there.
Yeah,
and somehow they didn't work. But I wanted to like raise the energy of that moment of the kids coming out of the of school with this music that is not even incidental. It's just like it's coming from where is it coming from? It's just a song. And we were still on the quest because nothing quite worked to get the energy there. And one day I'm hanging with my friend, one of my friends in LA, and he tells me, oh, so he invites me to this concert, and he's friends with Ian Astbury from The Cult, and he's there with his wife, and we're introduced. And yeah, the night was great. We were going to see a Sigur Rós concert, and at the end of the night, I am like, The Cult, of course. So 2 days later, I try the song, and it works perfectly. And it was, it was one of those things that, you know, it's like, how didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
I had a band when I was like 18, 17, and we used to like cover
The Cult,
and that song in particular. So, you know, I guess it wasn't in a hidden drawer in my heart.
I love how as well that shows a sign that you're never not working. You're always thinking about the film.
Yeah.
Even when you're out with friends at a concert, you're always thinking about it. Yeah. I hope we can chat again for your next project, but congratulations on this. Great, great to meet you. Thanks, Adam.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Soundtrack to It, that's Love Removal Machine by The Cult, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Andy Machete. A huge thanks to Andy for taking the time to talk to us. It Chapter 2 is on general release around the world now and is well worth watching. Back to back, I would suggest, with the first film. Benjamin Wallfish's Bendy score, meanwhile, is available via Warner Brothers. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And don't forget, we now have a YouTube channel where we'll put up anything that doesn't quite fit in the podcast, such as my chat with Werner Herzog at the Sheffield Doc Festival. Next up sees the return of Cillian Murphy alongside Peaky Blinders director Anthony Byrne. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.